Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. It's January 8th, 2015. Happy New Year. And this is our introduction to the Solari Report's 2014 annual wrap-up. We're very excited. The team has been working on it since November. This is the time of the year when we re-review everything bottom-up, looking at all the different trends and our framework, refresh, reaffirm, evolve, change. This is the process I use to look at scenarios for the next year, for 2015, and set my investment allocations and strategies. So it's a very important time for me to really make sure that we're grounded in an understanding of reality. And this is our way of communicating with you. I'm very excited about this one. It's in 10 parts. I strongly recommend that you work from the web presentation. The link is in your browser. We're going to be spending the month talking about this next week. We're talking with Joseph Farrell about 2015, what's ahead. It's his response to some of the things we discuss in the wrap-up. And the following week, John Rappaport, A Free and Inspired Life, the more intimate parts of what we learned this year and is in the wrap-up. So we're going to be having quite a conversation about it. We'll be also publishing a PDF that'll make it easier by the end of the month to print it out and to kind of sit and digest it if you prefer to look at it that way. So if you can link to the web presentation, follow along. I'm going to walk you through each of the 10 parts, do a little bit of a summary, and again, I really encourage you to dive in. The first part is our introduction, and I'm a great believer you tell them what you're going to tell them. And what we do is we summarize the gist of what we have to say in this wrap-up. We describe three important trends and then what we're thinking about, what it means. The first is global rebalancing. I thought it was important to revisit the rebalancing that's been underway ever sort of the dam was brought down by the Uruguay round of GATT. So we started in the 90s, and that was an acceleration of a process that's been going on for years. But we're rebalancing between the developed world and the less developed world. I use the example, the GDP per capita in India is 4,000. 52,000 in the United States. We're in a long-term process where someday they'll be approximately the same. And then, of course, that's true for equity market valuations in terms of whether market capitalization of GDP or PE ratios. What that means is that the securitization of everything is happening. And as I've said before, this is a once in a civilization time occurrence. You know, this will go on during this period and then it will be over, never to happen again. So it's going to be interesting. Now the pendulum's going to swing back and forth. It's going to be very organic, chaotic. It's going to be quite a clash of cultures and civilizations and finance. And as I said, I always love the Tina Turner question. We can do this nice or rough. In the process, that it's putting extraordinary pressures on the Bretton Woods system, which is unraveling, and I talk a little bit about that. One of the things that is pulling us together as the Bretton Woods system unravels is the growth of liquid equity markets globally. And again, a process that ebb and flows since in the last 25 years, the equity markets have grown by $60 trillion. Some of that is certainly debasement of the currency, but it's also the increasing amount of every economy around the world that's being reflected in the publicly traded stock markets. And we're seeing exchanges rise all around the world after the wall came down in the Soviet Union, so Eastern Europe, Russia, and of course, China, the big juggernaut. So the rise of equity markets and exchanges is something that's building interdependence around the world, and it's in another way, it's pulling us together. The final trend I talk about is the creation of a global currency and why it's so important to the leadership to build a global currency. I have a little section in the intro called Why Rebalance, and I discuss the fact that, in fact, we're working towards becoming a civilization that is on more than one planet. And if you're going to communicate across planets, then you're going to need to have much more of a global governance structure and currency. And so that is, in fact, what's happening. And if you step back and look at the very big picture on this process, what you realize is this is going to be going on for a long, long time. And no matter how chaotic it seems and how it seems that things are falling apart, in fact, they're coming together in a whole new way. And what that looks like has many questions to it. But I think what you can count on is a lot of the long-term opportunity is in those deep and long-term trends. What I my sort of response to this is we have struggled here in the United States for many years now with financial commentators simply asking us to buy into ridiculous models. One model that I describe is just trust the establishment, put everything in index funds and don't think about it. The other is we have all sorts of cranky commentators who are trying to persuade us that the world works in a variety of different ways. You know, gold's going to 8,000, everything's going to collapse tomorrow. These are all the alternative models. And in fact, they refuse to look deeply at what's really going on in terms of the black budget, the kind of things we've covered in the Secret Space program. And I think as their models become more and more outdated and grow further and further and more divergent from reality, there's going to be real pressure this year to finally turn and look at reality. And so what I've said is I reject both pathways. My preference is not to be either dependent on the establishment or a cranky victim, but rather to just simply look at reality and use the resulting intelligence to find a pathway through, but one where we get to live a free and inspired life. So that's why it's been so important to me to ask the question, who's really running things? And face the fact that we don't really know, which means our models can't possibly work. You can't explain what's going on in any version of the official reality. So, three big trends: the global rebalancing, global equity markets pulling us together towards a global currency. A lot of the stories that we picked out for this year relate to those very long-lived and deep trends. The second part is called Money Maps of the World. One of the things I discovered this year as I traveled around and talked to different groups of subscribers at lunches and the one workshop we did in California is that my picture of the world was very different. One, because I was very much looking at both geography, natural resources, and basic military statistics. For example, the United States has 10 aircraft carriers. China has one aircraft carrier. The United States has a global GIS satellite system. China only has a regional satellite system. So when someone at the workshop said, well, you know, the Chinese are going to run the reserve currency shortly, I said, I don't think so. I don't think it's going to work like that. Anyway, I thought we could revisit basic grounding and statistics that might help you understand sort of the competitive positions in the world. And the reality is the United States sits on one of the best pieces of real estate in the world. And you can see why if you after you look at statistics. And if you realize that the United States and the Anglo-American Alliance are in fact often acting in concert, they represent a very significant economic and military force. So take a look at the money maps and some of the comments. It's a good time to refresh yourself in basic geography. The picture at the top of the wrap up is an ancient picture of the Silk Road, and one of the things I point out is a lot of the squabbling going on around the world relates to efforts by the U.S. to assert control of the Silk Road. Our big theme for the annual wrap up was planet equity. I was online, I think it was the Wall Street Journal. And they had a selection of stories. They were asking people to vote for the top story of the year. I chose the Alibaba IPO and afterwards found that the 2% of the voters agreed with me. The vast majority voted for stories I considered entirely fabricated or completely irrelevant to the trends that are going to be shaping our lives in 2015. I chose the Alibaba IPO as the most important story because it really speaks to planet equity, which is the power of the equity markets as they grow to create global financial interdependence and to offer capital opportunities to people who've never had it. If you want a great example of that, Jack Ma was an English teacher. He started Alibaba in the mid-1990s in his living room in China. 20 years later, he's launching the largest IPO in the history of the world. For a company that has a market valuation which is larger than the GDP of many countries. But what's so interesting is Alibaba really speaks to the explosion of the online consumer market in Asia, the impact that that is going to have on all of our lives. But the fact that Jack Ma is showing up on Wall Street and commanding attention from many influential investors when he's talking about the importance of serving the dreams and the aspirations of small business and the little guy who normally Wall Street and Washington really spit on. So it was a remarkable turn of the tables. The global stock markets are growing. As I said, they've grown about $60 trillion in the last 25 years. I think they're going to grow another $60 trillion. I don't know if that's going to be 10 or 15 years or 25 years. But it's quite dynamic because we're watching the whole outside of the G7, we're watching all the countries outside of the G7 really begin to build equity markets and equity exchanges and deepen the liquidity and the power of those markets. It's a very dramatic goings-on. You don't read about it that much. What you've got is you've got thousands of companies all around the world trying to go solve the problems of the world, but they do it quietly. It certainly pays them financially to you know, keep their mouth shut until they're successful and then go about their business. I used the quote from Jack Ma at the top of the section. If you want to grow, find a good opportunity today. If you want to be a great company, think about what social problem you would solve. Very good quote from Jack Ma. Anyway, one of the things that we're watching is we're watching very dramatic differences in the PEs and in the different stock markets. And as I said, the process of rebalancing globally means that someday we'll reach a world where we're going to reach parity in the how much of the economy is represented in the equity markets, but also at what valuations market trades at. But there's tremendous arbitrage occurring all around the globe until that happens. There are a couple big swing questions when you look at the future of the equity markets. A big one in the United States is, will young people invest? Traditionally, U.S. households have been major, major investors in the equity markets, both directly and through their pension funds and retirement accounts. As the centralization of wealth continues in the United States and the middle class gets squeezed, the question is, are they going to continue to invest major assets in the equity markets? That's a big question. And of course, what polls show is the younger generation is very much turned off to the financial system as a result of what happened in the financial crisis. And I put up a section where I described some of the different things. There's a real, somebody hit a button at the beginning of the last year and started to really get the major financial institutions to try and market to young people. I give some examples of some of the software techniques that are being used to sort of make it very appealing. I know one of the problems I have financially is I can buy a book with one click. So imagine if we can all buy stocks, you know, with a 3D headset with one click. Anyway, so I put up some of the sort of the clever things that are being done to attract the millennial generation into the equity markets. A bigger question is, will the emerging market in middle class buy? We're watching globally the rise of a new group of middle class people. Traditionally, if you look at the emerging markets, folks in those countries have invested in gold and bank deposits and in real estate, big real estate investment, but really not in securities. And of course, the financial crisis didn't help securities appeal to them more. So the question is, will they be equity investors? And that has a very swing impact on what's going to happen in the equity markets. If you look at some of what is needed to finance infrastructure around the country, because I would argue that the developing nations really have raced their economies ahead of what the infrastructure should be and could be doing. There's a real need to encourage investors to support that in the equity market. So we'll see if that happens. But that potentially could have a very dramatic impact. Will the emerging markets middle class become equity investors? Finally, big question, who's going to govern the financial markets? My final comment is I think the Anglo-American Alliance has tremendously hurt their brand with the lawlessness in the financial system under their governance. The question is, can they maintain leadership with that lawlessness presence, or will that leadership go and shift to a more global structure or the BRIC, a combination of the BRIC nations? No way to know, but it's been a very important part of Anglo-American power, and we're reaching a point where there's real issues regarding brand and authority and respect. So it'll be interesting to see how that gets sorted out. Planet Equity, big theme for this wrap-up. Check it out. Check that section. Next section is stories and trends. What we did after Planet Equity is the most important theme, was pick out the 12 themes that we thought were very much present in 2014, but we chose ones that we think will continue in 2015. Many of them you've heard us talk about before. And for each theme, we picked a story that really epitomizes that theme in a very interesting way. So let me just march through the 12. And if you click on news stories and trends, we'll go through them together. But I would encourage you to read this at your leisure. First one, we nailed it on the Solari report. Jim Norman came on and described how the U.S. was playing the oil card against the Russians again, and that the oil price could drop to 40, and wow, did he call it. It wasn't amazing. The deeper trend, I said, is the east-west pendulum swings back and forth as the flow grows, and an important part of that is the U.S. trying to assert dominance of the flow in Eurasia as the trade between Europe and Asia grows in importance and power, and the population in that area grows. So we talk a little bit about that, but the oil card and the east-west rebalancing, or the pendulum swings back and forth as the flow grows, was our first. Our second was Global 3.0 rises, and the story I chose was the Vatican digitizes. The idea that the Vatican would digitize and open their archives is amazing, but there were signs of the 3.0 popping out all over the world, and I went through and described some of them. Number three is Global 2.0 struggles, the unraveling. There was a great piece by can you believe I just said that? But the head of the CFR published in the November-December issue of Foreign Affairs, Richard Haass, described the unraveling of the Bretton Woods system, castigating the neocons. You could see he's frustrated. And suggested some improvements to U.S. leadership, which is basically, please, President Obama, stop listening to the neocons. But what was chilling was he closed with a prediction, quote, "The question is not whether the world will continue to unravel, but how fast and how far." I think that's a very important statement, because that's exactly what we're watching. We're watching that unraveling. We've certainly seen 2 weeks of unraveling in the last 2 weeks in Europe. But Global 2.0 is clearly struggling. The fourth trend is uncivil society. Our story is the Ebola shriekometer, which was my word for the tactic that the Republicans played in the 3 weeks before the midterm elections this year to play the Ebola card. And the important thing to understand about that tactic was that it worked. It was very successful in putting the Republicans over the top, and they returned to the Congress with a majority in both houses. The subliminal message was very raw and uncut. Black people like the Democratic president, and the black and brown people he allows into the country bring disease. So very unpleasant. But we saw throughout the year, that was just one example, a tremendous shrieking of all kinds in the media. It was very unpleasant. The Gallup polls said towards the end of the year, a bleak 40% of Americans told Gallup that they place a great deal or fair amount of trust and confidence in the mass media, tying the all-time low recorded 2 years ago. Trust in the media has been edging downward since the late 1990s and early 2000s. Part of this is as the media shifts onto smartphones, onto the internet and onto smartphones, you're watching the economic model change, and you're watching some very wealthy, successful people, corporations suddenly finding the cash flows cutting away from them. And I think part of the shrieking is just to try and get attention. But it's clearly very unpleasant. As a result, we did, I wrote a commentary, a series of commentaries called Promoting Women, and then I did a Salieri report with Junius Ricardo Stanton on unpacking the divide and conquer. I would say the worst part of the shriekometer and the uncivil society was all the money poured into coming up with intellectual justifications of inequality that were very unpleasant. I describe it more, and you can read it at Stories and Trends. Education Tsunami is number five, and the story is the Common Core Death March. As you know, I think there's a if you look at what's happening with the Common Core curriculum, it is literally designed to destroy the U.S. public education system. And what it's doing is it's creating an extraordinary divergence between American students and students anywhere around the world who have access to the internet and have a real desire to learn and have great teachers. As I said in the example, impoverished children in a remote village in Outer Mongolia with an intelligent, caring teacher can outperform a group of American students because they're not burdened with literally tens of thousands of hours of handicap of curriculum disinformation and student loans. So something's going to have to give. And the reality is, at this point, your children can't get a decent education in public school. So it's hard for me to believe a generation of American parents are going to doom their children to global irrelevancy. So I think something has to give, and this is very serious. Trend number six is emerging the global currency, and the story I chose was Russia creates a national payment system. However horrible a year you might have had in 2014, I assure you the guys who the guys or gals in charge of Visa and MasterCard's Russian operations had it worse. So I tell the story of Putin's squabbles with Visa and MasterCard, and of course, Russia announced they were starting a new payment system, and Visa and MasterCard had no choice but to go along. But all around the world, what we're seeing is the BRIC nations try to emerge new systems and new relationships. Part of that is, I think, clear understanding that the dollar is rising and could continue to rise. And if they don't find ways of trading direct, if they have to go through the dollar, they're really over a barrel. But I also think that there is, Mr. Global was not happy with the speed at which the American build-out was going on the global currency. They wanted to see a little more competition and redundancy. So we're clearly seeing the BRIC nations move to do a variety of multiple kinds of systems and institutional infrastructure, and it's going to be one of the most interesting things to watch over 2015. Number seven is the 21st century shift into space. The story is the Rosetta landing a probe on the Comet that they had been escorting since August. It's very exciting. The Rosetta was launched by the European Space Agency in 2004, and its mission, which took 10 years to rendezvous with the comet that was part of the mission, and then they finally landed the probe in November, and it was quite exciting. I put a link up to the video of the space of the operations team watching the probe happening and congratulating each other. It's very inspiring. I want to keep encouraging you to take a look at what's going on in space. If you look at the effort in North America to build out our space capacity, you have NASA going around talking about starting colonies on Mars. I believe they were probably already have them, but now we're admitting publicly that this is what we want to do. And as I said, we're trying to get to the point where we're a more than one planet civilization. That's a very, very big step. And of course, the Russians, the Chinese, many countries around the world, as we do it, understand the importance of not letting one country get control of space. And so we're really seeing a kick up in activity and an importance of space as more and more money goes onto the sub or systems go onto the suborbital platform, and the global currency works through the suborbital platform. Then everybody's got a stake in how that's governed and managed. So keep an eye on space because it just grows more important. Trend number eight is transhumanism. The story is Elon Musk's warning on artificial intelligence. I put up the video if you haven't watched it. It's really tremendous. His comments are short, but they're dead on. I agree with him totally. There's great risk to artificial intelligence. I suggested some books you can read on transhumanism. It's one of the topics that's not on a lot of people's radar right now, but I think I'd like to encourage you to move it up because I think it's important. Number nine is wicked problems. If you don't know the definition of wicked problems, I encourage you to take a look. Wicked problems are problems that, as you try and solve them, get more complicated and get harder to solve. One of the story I chose was a group of physicists announced that they had proved that parallel universes did exist. And it was funny. When I read the story, I was trying to determine whether the drop in oil was the oil cart entirely or whether any of it was breakthrough technology impacting valuations. And if you think it's difficult figuring out equity optimizations as a result of dropping oil prices, you can imagine what could happen if parallel universes start to interact with ours. Anyway, so it's a wicked problem. But we're watching more than a few wicked problems. I named some of them. I'm sure you can name more. Number 10 is the demographic derby. We've known for many years we're coming into what's called the demographic winter in the G7. It's part of why the financial coup d'etat happened. The story I chose was Obamacare, and the Tea Party fails to stop Obamacare. I repeated the commentary I put up on the blog that shows why the Tea Party failed. The number one driver in the U.S. stock market is healthcare over the last 2 years, and sure enough, Obamacare and the Supreme Court's decision to affirm Obamacare has had a great deal to do with that. Check out the numbers. The demographic winter really kicks in with a real power in 2015, and we're going to feel more and more of the effects of it. It's one of the reasons you're seeing so much immigration supported both in Europe and the United States. It's a way to kind of offset that, and it's one of the reasons why I don't care what the political pushback is. The demographic winter is going to, the elite's a lot more afraid of the demographic winter than they are of sort of the reaction against immigration or the political issues of immigration. When you look at the numbers, you can kind of see why they're doing what they're doing. Number 11 is food and water grow scarce, and the story is food prices rise. I don't need to tell you about that. If you shop for groceries, you already know. I keep banging the drum every year, particularly in the annual reports. Please, please, please invest in making sure you have access to quality fresh food and meats as well as quality water. I made a couple suggestions of different things you can do. One of my concerns, of course, is weird weather and the contribution it's making. If you look at parts of Southwest United States, California, as well as other places around the world, serious droughts. If we get another year or two of serious drought in California, you're going to start to see migration. So, something to keep an eye on. Number 12 is the opportunity in infrastructure, and the story is high-speed trains. Specifically, China proposes high-speed trains to Europe and to the United States. Remember, China has 1.4 billion people on a landmass that's smaller than the United States landmass, and we have significantly more arable land than they do, although they irrigate tremendously. So if they do put in a high-speed train to Europe and the United States, guess where those 1.4 billion or many of those 1.4 billion people are going to go? Anyway, one way to create employment, significantly improve productivity, reduce environmental pollution, build greater independence and cooperation is to build infrastructure. I'm very big on building infrastructure. And of course, as we see the monetary stimulus slowing down, we're seeing calls for fiscal stimulus in the form of building infrastructure. And in fact, if you do it right, you can significantly improve, you can have very positive returns from both public and private investment in infrastructure. This does not include what I call piratization. We saw a great article this year from The Economist with a big red cover saying $9 trillion sale, proposing we sell lots of infrastructure from government into private companies. The problem with that is usually it happens at a below market price. So we subsidize private companies at the expense of the general population and the common good. It is one way to keep corporate profits up. That's the big question in the equity markets, how the corporate profits keep happening. But I, for one, am very keen. And if you look at sort of all the different technological developments, there's a real opportunity to really integrate them into the infrastructure, making things much more productive. I put up a link to one of my favorite documentaries on infrastructure. It's called The Seven Wonders of the Industrial World from the BBC, and it's a reminder of the dramatic impact that great infrastructure can have on our world and how it can dramatically increase productivity, which is something we absolutely need around the world. I also posted at the end of Stories and Trends links to some of the previous wrap-ups, which are, you know, this wrap-up sort of feeds and works off of those, especially the ones in 2014. And I also put up links to some of the year-end reviews that I reviewed, including the one from Kickstarter. Very inspiring. 3.3 million people from nearly every country on the planet used Kickstarter to fund 22,252 creative projects to the tune of 529 million. One of those projects chosen to represent Kickstarter at the Maker Faire in New York was crowdsourced with Karen Diggs, and she joined us on the Solaria Report. So one of those we managed to get on the Solaria Report. If you're interested in crowdfunding, that's a wonderful Solaria Report. I recommend it to you. Another one, favorite, is Cornell professor Dave Cullum has a wrap-up that is published in Peak Prosperity. I found that by far the most useful. I put a link to that, as well as John Rubino's 2014 review, How Could Gold Bugs Have Been So Wrong, and some of the others. I was very surprised this year in the corporate media, the wrap-ups were amazingly superficial and really promoted sort of the fabricated stories. And, they're less meaty every year. I was quite amazed. But I thought there were a few and you would find useful. Okay, next section is financial markets. And I do a roundup of the markets and lots of charts. So let's go to that. The U.S. market continued strongly in the United States. The S&P was up 11.4%, the Dow up 7.5%. The big surprise, who could believe it? The bond market just rocked at the 20-year Treasury ETF, up 27% for the year. If you had asked me at the beginning of the year if that was possible, I said, no way, anything's possible, but really not that. The 10-year was up 9%, or the intermediate was up 9%. The corporate bond aggregate was up 6%. So the bond market really was the star. Emerging markets, where we were hoping for opportunities, didn't happen. Down almost 4%. Gold started off strong in the year and then ended up flat, with silver down 18%. Commodities really got clocked. The CRB index was down 18%, but there was some wide variation, and I show you one chart. The Baltic Dry Index came down over the year, really representing the global slowdown. Interest rates kept coming down. Who can believe it? Anyway, we have enormous number of charts. One of the things I showed you is the extent of the repurchases and buybacks in the equity markets. We've depended very heavily on financial engineering to keep earnings growing, with companies borrowing money or using their cash stores to buy in shares. So we're really shrinking the market. I put up the sectors that did well. What you can see is the real leader again was healthcare, followed by technology, and then real estate and utilities. Investors clearly buying yield and looking for yield because there was none to be had in the bond market. And then I show you some breakdowns, the drop in oil with Russia along with it, the solar ETF going down with oil. And one of the there were some of the emerging markets that did well. China's done very well, and over the last year, China's up much more strongly than the S&P. At the end of the year, it was a tiny bit more than the S&P, but it's really continued to diverge up against the S&P since the beginning of the year. The frontier markets were strong during the year and then dropped and ended the year flat. I also show in my section on the fixed income the little chart that shows the annual income generated by 100,000 investment in 6 month CD. And what you really see is one of the great things in North America that squeezed them, and in the G7 that squeezed the middle class badly, is the drop in income on their savings. So if you look at what they're making on bank CDs or municipal bonds, they're just really getting squeezed. So the chart shows in 1990, you were making $9,000 a year on your $100,000 CD, and now you're getting $390 a year. That's quite a drop. Municipals did very well. A little chart from Joe Mysak at Bloomberg that shows them coming in for the year at 9%. Who would have thought? And a breakdown of some of the commodities. We see coffee and cattle, doing very, very well. And oil, of course, in the bottom of the barrel. And right above it was cotton. I live across from a cotton gin, so we felt it hard here in Hickory Valley. One of the great mysteries continues to be, I showed some of the precious metals charts. Nick Laird's charts on inventories for publicly traded ETFs and gold funds. And of course, we saw the huge drop at GLD, and it continues to shrink. That's not a function of the price going down. The inventory shouldn't change when the price goes down, but of course, GLD was set up so you could swap shares in to get physical. And the question is, of course, what is that about? It's one of the things Farrell and I speculate on in our will speculate on in our interview next week. So that's the financial roundup. Take a look. The next story we go to is 2015, Get Ready, Get Ready. And that's when I bring this complete look down to my assessment of scenarios for the year. In 2014, at the wrap-up that I gave at January 2014, I said 80% chance of slow burn. And of course, that's what happened. It was very uncomfortable this year. Everybody keeps thinking that I like the slow burn. And I finally said to somebody, no, I've despised it my whole life. But, that doesn't. So when I say I expect it, it's not because I'm happy about that. I did something I've never done before, and I divided the slow burn into two scenarios this year. One was volatile and violent slow burn, which I give a 50% chance of happening, and the other was North American Renaissance slow burn, which I gave a 40% chance of happening. Violent and volatile slow burn is inspired by the fact that I think this unraveling of the Bretton Woods is going to be very painful for everybody, including the United States. And as the United States tries harder and harder to maintain control and dominance over the flow, they're going to get more and more forceful in ways that are going to be painful for everybody. Meantime, I do think we run the risk that the US dollar index, which was up by 12% last year, could rise by another 10 to 25%. If that happens, you're going to see global dollar borrowers way over a barrel. It's the way the United States and G7 can really jerk the leash of all the BRICS nation. The pressure in the bond market could be extraordinary. There's a reason that Bill Gross ran away from home, and this is it. When a trader says, there's no liquidity in the market, that's a very frightening thing when you're sitting on top of a big fixed income portfolio. But we're going to see a lot of implosions and a lot of sort of institutional shifts, and it's going to be painful and uncomfortable, and things can get quite nasty as they did in Paris the other day. So I think a lot could fall apart and a lot of relationships could shift, and that could be very painful in many ways. It can look much more scary in economic terms than I think it is. So 50% chance of a volatile and violent slow burn. Oil dropping 50%, in a relatively short period of time is a perfect example of the kinds of things that happen, a volatile, violent slow burn. North American Renaissance says the Anglo-American alliance pulls into itself. It's very good at engineering covert operations around the world, but it keeps the violence at a minimum within North America. The consumers benefit tremendously from deflationary forces, so low-cost imports that come from a high dollar, lower energy prices that come from lower oil, lower commodity prices because everybody, the BRICS are in a global slowdown, and new technology adds just enormous productivity to the economy, whether it's robotics or fabrication technology. And immigration is used to replenish intellectual capital, get skilled labor, and keep the demographic winner at bay. There is divergence in the domestic economy, so the economy will feel very strong in areas that are enjoying global 3.0 reinvestment, like San Francisco. The areas left behind, like where I live in Tennessee, can feel like an economic depression that sort of kept afloat by government subsidy. So it's going to be spotty. The U.S. weaponry and military makes it possible for the U.S. to manage the Treasury and the derivatives market without serious public incident. And the U.S. government can use its relative financial security to ease up on some of the lawlessness. I do think the tremendous arrogance and lawlessness of the sort of the U.S. leadership has really come home to bite it in a variety of ways domestically and internationally, and it's at the point where the brand is in serious jeopardy. And so even though I do think you have the ability to put everybody in over a barrel, you know, and sort of pull in the leash, I'm concerned that there is a real brand issue. There's a real question about the mandate of heaven, and I think the United States has been buying a lot more trouble than it needs to. Anyway, but through the sort of success of the young people in immigration, the accomplishments of American technology, and the relative strength, you get sort of this North American renaissance. Although I guess again, it's very spotty. And in the meantime, the economies of the U.S., Mexico, and Canada continue to integrate rapidly. Part of that is financed by the expanding access to the U.S. street drug market by the Mexican drug cartels, which will continue to be felt. So I give that scenario about a 40% chance. What I would say is there are a lot of places that are going to think they're in a North American renaissance, a lot of other places that are going to think they're in a volatile and violent slow burn, and they're going to be right. The next scenario is the 2008 Redux, and that's a repeat of the financial crisis, of what happened during the financial coup d'etat. You hear a lot of spin on the internet of people saying that is going to happen momentarily. I give that a 1% chance. I think it is very unlikely that we see a repeat of the last financial crisis, not to say we won't have, sort of unbelievable volatility around the world and that global 2.0 won't be struggling and coming apart. I do think if we're in a situation where we have another 2008, in fact, that's not going to happen. We're going to have World War III. So my concern is war or a very devastating environmental disaster as a result of something that was a war, like an EMP attack. I give this scenario an 8% probability because I think cooler heads will prevail. I would note The Economist had a big special edition on 2015, and one of the pictures on it, there were many, it was not just a few, was a nuclear mushroom cloud. It was kind of a little bit scary. What is The Economist proposing here? So I think cooler heads will prevail, but I do think there's a chance that it could happen. Our biggest risk individually is, the kind of things that happen locally. So I'm not worried about global collapse, but I am worried about short-term local collapses like Katrina, the Kentucky power outage. Weird weather is definitely upon us. So please don't laugh at the preppers. You want to have resiliency in your personal arrangements. You want to have disaster recovery plans. I have one for home and business. I think it's important that we all do. So whether you're addressing disaster recovery or cyber hacking, fire, theft, or increased regulatory enforcement, let me beat the drum one more time. Please keep excellent and multiple copies of your financial records. Very, very important to do. The next scenario, the last scenario, is transformation. I give that scenario 1% probability of happening in 2015, but I think as the violent and volatile rises, as the Bretton Woods unravels and we get this great unraveling, I think more and more people are going to start to realize, look, there's nothing to be gained from this kind of lawlessness. We really need to revisit the fundamentals of culture and why we're here and how we build a peaceful, more cooperative world. So, I keep that transformation scenario on the plate because I think it's important to pray for it and to work for it, and that's part of what we're doing here at Zilleri. Now, let me translate that into markets. I think there's a good chance that the U.S. stock market will continue to be strong, but I don't see how it's going to match the performance of 2013 or 14. Corporate profits are stretched very thin, and PEs have received significant support from buybacks and the balance sheet reengineering. So, particularly if the Fed raises the interest rates this year, I would say if the Fed raises interest rates, I don't think the U.S. equity market should have a problem digesting it, since it will be gradual. And of course, a strong dollar will help in some ways, but in other ways, not so, because it's going to put a damper on exports and also a damper on foreign earnings translating into U.S. earnings. International equity markets, I think there'll be a lot of, again, during the volatile and violent slow burn, there's going to be a lot of opportunities to buy cheap if you're fearless. So it's going to be spotty, and the question is when and how. And a lot of what will happen, particularly in the emerging markets, will depend on how strong the dollar is. There'll be exceptions. We're seeing India and China, as I said, continue to be strong. Bank deposits, I still don't see any opportunity to get reasonable returns on savings in bank deposits, but I don't think there's going to be any problem with the viability of the FDIC system. And because people are going to want those insurance deposits, I think the banks are going to get plenty of money at a low interest rate. Housing, I'm concerned that housing prices are going to move up in areas where the global 3.0 investment is strong or foreign investment is strong. We had $22 billion from the Chinese over a year's period reported in 2014. It's not contiguous to the calendar year. It ended before the calendar year was up. But I would expect to see that continue despite a rising dollar, lots more foreign money coming in and buying real estate. So if you're in an area that's enjoying foreign investment or global 3.0 and you want to buy a house, be careful not to get shut out. Precious metals has done very well at the beginning of the year. It looks strong, but I'm suspicious. I'm very concerned if we do get the dollar really flying up and we do get global slowdown, that we could see the price break below the 1100 line. But anything can happen. I could be wrong. We'll just have to see what happens. What's driving this more than anything is physical demand in Asia or geopolitical instability, and that could send it the other way. But I would be careful with gold and silver. Of course, keep your gold core position, but make sure you understand it could be very, very volatile in 2015. For those who live in the United States, I put a list of what I think are the big risks that we're all facing, and it's very important that we all address. So check those out. They fall under the categories healthcare, education, software, hardware, mobile payment systems, fresh food and water, environmental pollution, wild cards, there is no way. And then one of the things I've said many times this year, but I'll say it again, you cannot be too careful with your associations, people, vendors, partners, as well as your sources of information. The times simply just require greater discernment in all thing. Vision 2020 is the next section. I talk a little bit about what some of the plans we have underway for 2015. I'm very encouraged about what we're doing in the Solaria report. I'm very excited about it. One of the things that had to give was to do what I do. I had to do more traveling. And I needed more time to focus on the kind of fundamental analysis that the Solaria report supports me in doing. And as a result, I made a command decision coming out of the free inspired workshop that we did in November that I would shut down the money management company that I was partnered in, C-Lane Advisory. And so I wanted to let you know that I have done that. And that for me is a very good development. It will make me much freer to travel, as I really feel I need to do. Part of the rebalancing of the global economy and the equity markets requires that I just be out there and be free to go and kick the tires, which is what I'm going to do. Our next section was best books for 2015. We got several requests for recommendations for the books that I think would help you most understand the environment. And we've put a list there for you, and feel free to ask any questions about that. And then our winners. Our hero for the year is Madison Bumgarner. If you're from San Francisco, you know who I'm talking about. He was the pitcher that led the San Francisco Giants yet again to a third World Series win. Remarkable young man from North Carolina. And one of the reasons we chose him as our hero is I love San Francisco. I love the people in San Francisco. I spent a lot of time in San Francisco, but I never thought I would see the day when the people of San Francisco would deeply respect and admire a good old Southern boy. For a long time now, I've received from the people of San Francisco great skepticism that anything in the heartland of America is worth their time and attention, and they've just gotten a giant lesson in all the great characteristics of people who live in the heart and the heartland. You know, there are many people, a few words, and lots of hard work, talent, and character, and Madison Bumgarner has done a great job of educating the people of San Francisco to what that looks like. So it's quite charming to watch it, and it shows you miracles happen. And if the folks in San Francisco can worship a guy who comes from a small town in North Carolina, then, you know, anything can happen. We can have transformation on the planet. The movie of the year is The Lives of Others, wonderful German film made in 2006. For those of you grappling with living in a world where there's deeply invasive technology by the government and private corporations, this is a brilliant, insightful movie that helps you understand some of the issues of dealing with a world. There was a story the other day that came out that personnel at NSA was using to listen in on their girlfriends and wives and family. And I thought, yes, everybody has to watch The Lives of Others. The documentary is a fabulous documentary that we had on Let's Go to the Movies, Jaworski's Dune, about Chilean director Jaworski, who acquired the film rights and did the pre-production work on Dune, and then Hollywood balked. It was a story, he had it as a story of great personal empowerment. Shows you a lot about what Hollywood doesn't want. Very interesting why the stuff getting through does not have the best that we could do, and why it's a great story about why crowdfunding, Netflix and Vimeo, all these developments open up significant pathways for real talent. I don't want to give away this whole punchline of the story, but one of the things that happened was when Jaworski was turned down, a lot of the material that was in the pre-production work then split and went out and became all the great sci-fi classics that we know. And what you'll see is the seeds of thousands of or hundreds of just scores of great sci-fi movies came out of that. It's quite interesting to see the sort of history of all these things that we thought were these different movies that instead came out of this one remarkable effort by a very remarkable, talented group of people. But it's a story ultimately of creativity and genius, and it's very enchanting. We have had so many requests for a list of all the movies we've and documentaries we've had in Let's Go to Movies that, in fact, we put it up on the wrap-up. It's there. You can get it. And then the final section is closing and credits. There's so many people who contribute to the Solaria Report, so we wanted to thank at least some of them, but a wonderful group of people who contributed this year, and they're all up there. So that's it. That's the 10 sections of the annual report this year. are the annual wrap-up this year. Let me go back again. Intro, most important to read. Money maps, please take a look. Planet equity, our big theme for the year. Stories and trends, 12 stories and trends that we think really capture the year and the important things that are coming up. Financial market roundup was a look at 2014. 2015, get ready, is a review of our scenarios. Some of the important things for you to think about to do. Vision 2020, what we're going to be doing to support you in 2015. Best books for 2015, and then the winners are, and closing and credits. Ladies and gentlemen, 2014 was a very productive year. We're really looking forward to 2015. Next up is the first quarter wrap-up. We're researching and thinking now about what big theme we want to really dig in and illuminate for you. So if you have any suggestions or things you want to make sure that we, coming out of this wrap-up, as you review, that you make sure that we review in the first quarter wrap-up, which we'll publish in April, let us know. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, during 2015, don't ask if there's a conspiracy. Don't worry about if there's a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Good night and good luck.